going to be put pilot hole in, like I said, and that part comes in, and then suddenly you find that the tooling is good enough, so you tell them make the holes full size, and here in the shop they build the holes full size. When the parts come together, they fit. So this is where we're different in this country. In Europe, they tend to build airplanes in the engineering drawings. And we don't. We do, as I mentioned there, variant. You can leave, instead of cutting it right to size, you can leave a little extra material on it. It can be hand cut. If it's a compound curve you're not sure of, if you cut it to size and fabrication, get so that the airplane won't fit. No air, an airplane, everything could be off an inch and you'd make no, practically no difference. An inch off the engineering drawings. As long as everything matches and fits, I would say that that would be safe in most cases at that time. Now it may be because of supersonic flights, it may be a little different. Well, the fabrication shops make the part that's specified on the fabrication outlines, and their scheduled due date calls for the for this on the fabrication order. Now, the fabrication order, he has to, by the flow chart, he has to make, have the part made in time to get to the assembly person that wants to, that assembly person at 2 o'clock in, on a certain day is supposed to put that bracket on the fuselage. And if it isn't there, you've got a shortage, and it can turn into what they call a line stopper, which is the worst. The airplanes don't move because somebody failed to get the parts there.
Well, after some point in the production, is there sufficient stockpiling of the fabricated parts?
Yes, gradually. The shortage shortage control is one of the biggest specialties at the start of the airplane. And you finally found the vendor in New York couldn't keep up with the schedule. He promised anything to get the work or wherever the work was being done. And so you have to take extraordinary measures to make sure the work is performed on time. Eventually, you never get away from shortages. There's always something takes place. But you reduce it, and it's more reliable. For instance, the engineer comes out with a bracket that's forged. Well, they go through and everybody calls for forgings, and the forging industry is only half big enough to take the load. So you suddenly have a bunch of parts the engineer called for as forging, and you can't get them forged any place in the country. And this happened time and time again. So what you do is you ask the engineer to put out what they call a hog out drawing. So the engineer puts out a drawing that takes a big chunk of metal and you carve the part out, which is very costly, until you can get the forging. What do you mean? I get the forging to 100th airplane. And castings are just as critical too. And so there is a problem of when what the engineer thought was the economical design, and it was, no one can conform to it. But the trick is, of course, is to wander through the engineering department and find out who is making forgings, and right there say, hey, look, we can't get any more forgings made. And you're going to have to put a substitute drawing in so we can hog it out of fire stock, as you call. We had one airplane at the Douglas Elsing Under plant that was called the Flying Bar Stock. And it was mainly because a Caltech professor, Major Klein, Dr. Klein, who was a consultant of the Douglas Company, went through on the smaller airplane and convinced everybody just before the war broke out that forging was the way to go. And he's a brilliant, demanding obnoxious friend of mine, but he had his way, and some guy on the design board sees this fellow with all these credentials coming up. You just switch over and design it the way he was pushing you. And it turned out that there wasn't a chance of doing the job, so they took bar stock, which is solid, and bought out, and finally met delivery, but not without some delays. Any major changes in the airplane are scheduled or rescheduled through the use of a negotiated change schedule. All, and this was one of the big changes in World War II. To get a change into an airplane, people enthusiastically and others pushing would say, well, we'll make that change on the 100th airplane, and they can't possibly do it. So we came up, and we were the first at Douglas Lundy to incorporate a negotiated change schedule. We took the change, we went around to engineering and everybody, quality and planning and shop and tooling and everybody, and got them to sign that you could meet ship 800. Now, the engineer says he can meet it, but if you put a date down there that you must have your drawing out by this date, he may not be able to meet it. So he asked for more time. Well, that immediately pushes everybody else out down below. And you find that fabrication and assembly and so forth, they say, well, if this guy does it, I can do mine. But you get everybody's signature, and you come up with a realistic schedule, and we finally got this working, and it guaranteed a better airplane earlier in schedule by informing everybody about the change before it happened, and it caused a change in management at Lundy. The management would come in with a change, release the change through engineering, and the first thing the shop or tooling or planning would know, here's a set of drawings with a change. They never even heard of it. That was lack of getting together, and there were feelings, you know. And that got changed, and it cost the plant management at that time, it cost them their jobs in 1942. So this is an important document, and we finally would sign for when we could make the change. Repeat releases are carried out by issue of fabrication outlines. In other words, the first one went out maybe for 3 airplanes, the next one comes out for 5, and then 20, and then 50, and then 100, and then 200 on a monthly basis. Now, there's one big item that sometimes is not talked about in the program of fabrication and assembly. It's called installation. You install a machine gun, you install an ashtray, you install many things that when you receive this great big hull, the fuselage and the wing, then you add items that are called installation items and are not part of the main structure. They just hung on to the structure.
So at what point is that done? During the sub-assembly stages then?
Yes, and assembly and final, they have a phase of the airplane called final installation. Everything has to go in at that point. The engines have to be in there and everything. Now, the trick is if you can visualize an airplane that takes 40 positions to build, and each position is so many people in so much time and so forth. Now there's a tendency due to shortages for the bracket we talked about. Mm-hmm. It isn't available to go in at position 29 like it should have. So they let it slip to the next position, but the thing is still short, so it slips to the next position. And pretty quick it's going in down here and it's accepted. And if you're not careful, all the installations and final touch-ups go down and get close to the door. And you find then the airplane just sitting there waiting for parts. And that part should have gone in upstream. Well, if you're on your toes, you send planners out and production control people, and you constantly take stuff that drifted downstream and you move it back upstream. And then you'll find that other parts will begin to slip downstream. You should always move the stuff back, continuous program of moving it back upstream where it's cheaper to put in because the accessibility. The main thing here, the reason it's all broken down like that exploded view I showed you, is that people can get to work. Now, Boeing did it a different way. Boeing tended to put the big chunks together and then crawl inside and make the installations. At Douglas.
On the B-17?
And any airplane. Mm-hmm. The B-17s or any airplane. And Lockheed sort of that way. Douglas believed in a big breakdown. Now, when you're at war, you can tend to do this. But in the commercial market, every extra position you put in that's not needed, you've got an inventory there that may run $100,000 just because it...
Because you're installing it sooner.
You get it installed at the right place. You have accessibility.
Mm-hmm.
You open it up into pieces and I'll come
in. Well, does that not account for the higher percentage of women in assembly at Douglas than at Lockheed because it was in smaller units?
Well, yes. On the C-47, for instance, General Arnold came around and said, look, I need 400 more C-47s than the schedule calls for. And you don't ask why or anything like that. You just go to work and do it. What he wanted them for was the invasion of Europe. And so we immediately had to up the schedule. Well, what seemed to be a very useful tool at this point was the female worker. So we rearranged a number of things in assembly to make it easier. The problem we had in terms of women couldn't lift certain things. If you could break it down into pieces they were allowed in, well, some of them could lift the whole airplane up the foot line, but in general, they were not as husky as the males as far as cutting stuff. So if you had a thing that weighed 50 pounds, and you could break it into two pieces, and with this woman over here and this woman over here, take 25-pound pieces and finish them. She could lug it into the stock room and handle them and turn them upside down. So we wound up with 87.5% women on that C-47 by recognizing the potential that we have. We could get more women to work. Now, the big problem was housing. We had to send a lot of work out to other towns because you couldn't attract labor in here because there was no housing. Well, if you take a house that's already here and the family living in it and the old man's working at the plant and you can put the wife to work and you haven't had a housing problem because they're already in the house. So in many cases, the women got a job simply because they had a place to live. And now it introduced complications of children and other things going to school, but this worked out very well. And we got up to 10.5 to 11 a day on the C-47 right away. And they did a fine job. And I'm not so sure that some of the moves we made weren't pretty universal, regardless of who went to work mm-hmm. on them, it made sense.
Mm-hmm.
It allowed us to accelerate faster.
Let me ask another question. In terms of the process of installation and shortages or delays in fabrication of certain parts so that installation is delayed later down the line, it sounds, given shortages and allocations during the war years, like there have to be continuous adjustments almost on the assembly of every plane depending on those shortages and allocations. So in a sense, it couldn't be totally routine. There may have to be adjustments
fairly
regularly.
The main thing, of course, is to keep the assembly line working. So you have hordes of people who are working on supplying material and parts and so forth. There are a lot of purchased parts that it isn't just raw material.
Mm-hmm.
You're buying seats and you're buying the doors, let's say, are built in San Francisco in one case, and outer wings were built in like Pullman in Chicago, and a lot of things were built in Detroit. And all of those things had staffs of people working on them to see if they got here on time. Now, that's quite a chore because the automotive industry, they just didn't get the hang of billing. And a lot of them had a strength enough of fear that they might have to fly in the article that they were building the parts for. And it's a funny thing. But they did bring that up. Because
mm-hmm.
I was sent to Detroit in 1940 as a technical rep with the automotive companies. And that was actually expressed to me as, well, I want this to be right. They'd ask a question that was elementary. And then they'd react with, well, I want to be right because I might have to fly in it. And they have a great respect for, more so than for an automobile.
Mm.
Well, go on here. Adequate breakdown of assembly components, of course, is fundamental for any program, airplane program, or any other type. A well-planned approach to breaking down the airplane, starting with the engineering design, that's necessary for a number of reasons. You want to increase accessibility for the workers, spread the work out, as we mentioned, and move it back up the line, from the final assembly positions, to simplify the individual production jobs. If you could break a job down to a single skill, rigging, of course, was the biggest single skill. But in fabrication, if you had a drill jig and you put the part in, and somebody could have the drill set up for them, and they just pull the handle down and drill holes all day long, that was simple. And young people and women coming out of the kitchen could do something like that. Men coming out of a clerical job or a haberdashery or whatever could also do it. You get down to foolproofing the tools so they can't put the part in wrong and drill it. That's quite a battle too. It requires an awful lot of people to break this airplane down, a large airplane like the one we're talking about, and they're constantly working on it because you can't do it once or twice or three times. It's refinement, 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 and eventually you see something you should have thought of, and then you issue a work order to move it from one position to another. The shortage chaser then has to recognize that it was due down here on April the 16th. Somebody moved them all up here and is now due in March. And if he doesn't know that, he's still chasing to get it in on April the 16th. He gets all upset. Well, I got it in. Well, we changed it. We moved it up here. Well, nobody told me. And that was quite true, too, trying to get the word out. So now he has to chase it, and he has to go out to the vendor, say, no longer can I accept it at this point, I now have to have it at this point. He gives him the paperwork, and the vendor may up the price of the article because of the change in requirements and so forth. So we're simplifying individual production jobs, and this allowed the use of relevant unskilled labor and unskilled labor. Prevent better overall utilization of floor space, which is important, and high clearance is important to provide maximum production expandability against the contingency of requirement for rapid and substantial increase in output, such as General Arnold asked us to do in 347. Incidentally, the programs bounce up and down during the war. Somebody said, well, we don't need that many B-17s, and they come in. In one day, the B-17 schedule changed three times. General Wolf came in the morning, and he set a schedule of four a day, and an accelerated schedule. We were at four a day, and he moved it up faster. When he left for lunch, my boss stuck his head in the planning office. He used a conference room and all spread out. He said the general wants five a day. So they went to lunch, we didn't. We worked to get it to all the loads and the acceleration and the application of people and the cost and all that sort of thing on paper. So when they got back, we turned that in. And then when he left the plan about 4 o'clock, he changed it back to 4 with a different rate. Well, he then went to see a buddy someplace. He left a lot of loose ends, and we couldn't find him. The general had a way of going into a retreat where only the president or somebody could get a hold of him. And if something didn't make sense, he just took a risk of interpreting. And that, as I look back, I was very safe because the next day he had a whole new set of plans. However, you feel a little anxious about it, particularly when they're shooting at you.
What happened, say, when there was a change in the production number per day? Would you have temporary layoffs then, even during the height of production in the war years?
Well, we would say that we can't lower the rate to three a day for 5 months because of the impact and the fact that we had trained workers we wanted to feed into other programs and move them perhaps to another plant, by this plant. So we had to, the only thing that chopped it off all once was the end of the war.
Mm-hmm.
What we had to do is plan the retrenchment and then try to sell it. Now the military could say cut that in half. And in fact they're saying we'll live with the breakage. And you do the best you can. Well, no matter how well that intention is viewed, it gets irritated. And you get frustrated, and you wish they'd leave you, let you alone and let you build airplanes. And in many cases, airplanes were built in excess, too, and they just sat at some field, nobody using them. That happened in the South Pacific, simply because we put a 75-millimeter cannon in the airplane, and the general down there, General Kinney, wanted 50-caliber machine guns, more. So he... See, the basic mistake was the 75-millimeter cannon was great in Europe, where it could shoot at a tank and pierce a tank, heavy, big oil tanks and things like that. It was pretty good for that. But there weren't tanks in all these little South Sea islands to shoot down, so 75-millimeter cannon wasn't what they wanted. And finally, we sent a group down to the South Pacific and got the message, came back, and we put more 50 caliber machine guns in the nose rather than 75 millimeter cannon. And things seemed so simple.
But the installation of the hardware then would occur as part of the final installation before the delivery was done by Douglas itself.
Oh yeah, when we sent it out, that airplane was ready to fight. Now, you'll find that that isn't always the case. They have, one thing you need is flexibility in an airplane. If they come in and say, I want armor plate around the pilot, and I want it right now, then you go to work to attempt to incorporate that change. Well, the airplane, while you're negotiating how fast you can do it and you're ordering the armor plate, time goes by. So here are a series of airplanes going out without armor plate. Well, if you can get enough armor plate going to supply your line and some more, they hold your airplanes at a modification center and they sit there awaiting the theater changes, the way the war was. So you send a bunch of armor plate up there and they put them, they put them on those airplanes, and then we put them on at the plant.
Now the modification centers would not be Douglas plants, they would be the military sites.
Yeah, they'd be run by somebody, but they would be started up by the military, and Cheyenne, Wyoming was one. And, the biggest one when Ford began building B-24s in conjunction with the Douglas Company, Ford had an automobile philosophy. And he believed the best way was to get a lot of airplanes out at a fixed design. Well, the trouble is, in 3 months, the needs on the B-24 could change drastically. So what the government did, they, Ford, an outfit like Ford can be bigger than the government. And like Western Electric now is certainly bigger than the Army on the missile committee and so forth functions. And so at that time, you had that problem of being a lot more powerful and making the Army do things your way, what Ford tended to do. He built inflexible lines. So what they did is they built a factory down in Marietta, Georgia. It cost $20 million to take the airplanes that Ford built, fly them down there and modify them so they could be used. Now, a general, you know, could say, no, I'm not going to use your airplane until you make the changes that I think will help win the war. And General Kinney's idea was a lot of 50 caliber machine guns, and he'd use them like a garden hose or a fire hose. They'd go and follow the leader up over, say, a Japanese ship, and they would just spray it with 50 caliber and keep on going. And the next guy can come by and spray everything. So we had 8 50 caliber guns in the nose and 3 on each wing. So you always had 14 50 caliber machine guns shooting forward. Well, that's pretty devastating if you're hitting the deck of a ship or something like that. And particularly if there's a bunch of guys in back that are doing the same thing and you keep going like that. So you can see the difference between a 75 millimeter cannon and a bunch of 50 caliber bullets, which are pretty rough. Well, let's see, in case of this C-74 airplane, they are still working with the nature of the assembly breakdown and this expandability concept of being able to turn the dial and get more airplanes out eventually. This was a 175-pound airplane and a 175,000-pound airplane. And the result of the degree of assembly breakdown is finally filtered into some artists, and they don't have to be in engineering. Quite frequently they're in manufacturing engineering, in fact most of the time. And you find that the fuselage in the C-74, for instance, would be made up of approximately 90 structural sub-assemblies in assembly. And those are joined into 7 major assemblies. And finally, 6 of these major assemblies are joined to form the fuselage structure. And then the 7th one is the tail end that's stuck on. Mm-hmm. So you find the fuselage then is broken down into 90 different chunks. And the wing has been similarly broken down, and it is in 70 structural and subassemblies, panels, and so forth.
What would each of these be called? Would they be considered panels, each of the 90 subassemblies?
There are vague terms, unfortunately. Major subassembly. A major subassembly could be the fuel tank of the wing, which this airplane carries 11,000 gallons of fuel. Well, you have two long spars going from the fuselage attachment out to the tip, and then they're boxed in like this, and they become the fuel tank.